From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how school choice has become the new white flight.
The parents will say they're going to a school that has better test scores, that there's less violence, they feel safer. Things that almost no parent could ever deny would be valid reasons to leave.
New development for downtown Detroit and principals sentenced to prison for a bribery scandal. Two sides of one city.
Those things really show you what's happening in Detroit. And it's not an either-or proposition, it's both.
Hearing voices, taking the stigma out of the voices only you can hear.
Things that we assume about, you know, that schizophrenia is a brain disease, it's a neurological defect, and instead it really looks at this as a natural human experience that happens to many people.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A doctor makes a case for a significant cultural shift in hospitals that could cut down on medical mistakes. Also, is Detroit evolving into a 21st century version of Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities? Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes explains. And what would you do if you began hearing voices in your head? But first, it has been more than 20 years since school choice became an option for Michigan families. It stemmed from the adoption of Proposal A and allowed students to switch to any district that would accept them. A new report in Bridge Magazine finds over 300,000 students, that's more than 20% of Michigan's K through 12 students, go to classes in either a charter school or a public school district that is different from the one in which they live. And as reporters Mike Wilkinson and Chastity Pratt Dossie of Bridge Magazine discovered, school choice is becoming Metro Detroit's new white flight. Mike and Chastity are with us now. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello.
Hello, Cynthia.
Defenders of school choice say, hey, hold on here. We're empowering parents, black, white, whatever, to find something better for their kids than what they see as a failing local school. But then what are we seeing as a byproduct of having these families voting with their feet, Mike?
Well, what's happened is the parents are choosing places that either by accident or design are less diverse than the ones in which their students live on, you know, most of the day. They're leaving during the day to take classes and get educated in a district that is typically more white. It is less poor than the one in which they live. The parents will say they're going to a school that has better test scores, that there's less violence, they feel safer. So, you know, the things that almost no parent could ever deny would be valid reasons to leave. What is happening is that we're seeing more and more schools that do not reflect the community where those kids live. You're seeing school districts that the school age population, let's say, is 50% white, but the schools themselves are 35% white. Where did that 15% go? Well, some went to private schools. But what we've noticed is, especially in Metro Detroit, but it does extend beyond the state, they're going to districts nearby that are whiter, that are less diverse, that are less poor. And we're creating, you know, some racial isolation pockets where there probably should not have been. For example, you know, a decade ago, there were 38 school districts in the state where more than half the kids were not white, a majority-minority school district. Well, last year, there were 55, and that doesn't include the fact that we dissolved Buena Vista and Inkster. And the number of charter schools where you had the majority-minority situation went from 119 to 182. So parents are choosing to self-segregate, are choosing to create these schools where, you know, there isn't the diversity that is reflected within the communities.
Chastity, what are your thoughts and what are you finding as far as what education experts think? Let's talk about the kids. What are the kids losing by not being educated near their neighbors?
Well, when you have school districts across Michigan, across the nation saying, look, we're preparing our students for a global society to be, you know, competitive on a global scale, that requires diversity. And what we're seeing in some districts, let's take Ferndale, for example. Ferndale had two elementary schools, one white, one black. And they say, look, this is not how children should learn. They should learn from each other. They should learn side by side. This has to end. And educationally, you know, socializing is a form of education. Learning about other people's culture and learning from each other, that's part of being educated globally. globally educated person. So Ferndale made the decision to say, look, we have one elementary school that's majority black and one that's majority white. This is not helping these children to be globally competitive, to be, you know, learning in a diverse setting and learning what it's like to learn with other people. So they're merging. They did merge this fall, those two schools, because it's educationally what's best for kids. And you'll see that from educators saying, look, you know, we've got to do this. It's what's best for kids.
But there's also an issue, speaking of Ferndale, with the high schools, Chastity.
Yeah, in Ferndale, they have a high school that draws nearly all of its students from Detroit, and all but two of the kids there last year were African American, whereas Ferndale High School is it's still majority African American, but they don't draw as many kids from Detroit. And so Ferndale, again, it's that district, entering district, that opened its border to students from Detroit, but is also understanding that they're experiencing some white flight, they're experiencing some segregation within the schools, and they want to reverse that in order to educate all kids together, side by side, in a way that's going to be educationally beneficial to everyone. So that's one of the few districts that has taken this issue on head on, noticed it, recognized it, called it by its name, segregation, and said, look, let's do something about this.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Bridge Magazine reporters Chastity Pratt-Dossi and Mike Wilkinson about their story, School Choice, Metro Detroit's New White Flight. You had an interesting quote caught my eye from a sociology professor at UNC, Dr. Rosalind Arlen Mickelson, on why the vision of integration, of having schools in black neighborhoods achieve equal results as schools in white neighborhoods, something that goes back decades, that vision. And here was her quote, parents don't want to make their children the sacrificial lambs on the altar of social science. Mike, what are you hearing from experts is the answer? Because she certainly doesn't seem to feel policymakers are going to recognize the benefits of diversity because they want the votes from those parents.
Well, and I think what she said, it points to the crux of what the problem is. The researchers believe that their research is very clear that having that diversity makes all kids, both the minority and the majority kid, learn better. They excel when they're in a setting where there is this diversity, not just of color, but of ideas and of background. So for them, it's really clear. But they understand, and what she was saying there, that it's such a hard sell with parents that you can't convince the parent that the reason they're leaving is invalid, that it's going to take someone else to make that decision for them. Now, decades ago, people had the same ideas. It took the federal court to say, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, separate but equal, was not allowable in this country. I don't know if I don't think anyone is advocating for that, perhaps, but she was frustrated by the fact that policymakers, because like you said, they need those votes. They know that there's the common sense of the parents that are thinking this, that they're not going to take her side and the research's side and come up with policies that better reflect what the research is showing.
You guys have done a lot of digging, and there's a lot of interesting statistics showing how things are changing in Metro Detroit districts, including that very cool interactive element. You plug in a district, and you can see how school choice has changed in that district. Mike, can you give us some idea of the districts where students are leaving in big numbers and the districts that are picking up new students? Because it kind of sounds like we're coming up with a list of winners and losers.
Well, what we've noticed is, and what we put on our website, bridgemi.com, is we looked at the census data. What does the school-age population look like? So you see in a place like Lincoln Park, 62% of the kids 5 to 17 are white in Lincoln Park. The school district's only 44%. So what happened? You had 1,900 of those kids opt out to other districts. Taylor, 63% school age, 55% within the school, 1,600 kids that have left. It's happened in Macomb County, where East Detroit, you have I think 40% of the district is white, but only 19% of the school is white. And what you've seen is their number one district that they go to is Lakeview, which is in the middle of St. Clair Shores. It's 85% white right now. And they've picked up almost half the kids of their total enrollment is coming from choice. The district was declining in size demographically. Not as many people with kids were in that district. Choice was a lifeline for them. So you could call them a winner. Well, when I was at the Detroit News, we did a story and we looked at Lakeview. East Detroit, because it was losing students, had to cut its band because it just did not have the money. Well, the influx of all the students at Lakeview allowed it to then give an instrument for free to every kid in fifth grade, which is great. Music is a wonderful tool for learning. It's a great opportunity. I would argue that, well, there's a winner, and who's the loser? Where did those kids come from? East Detroit, largely, and they had to cut their music program.
You pose a great question toward the end of this really in-depth piece. Is there a better way? And Chastity, have you gotten ideas from experts as far as ways that states can have choice but set rules that don't create winners and losers?
Well, what we hear from experts such as Gary Mirren, and I'm sure you know him from Western Michigan University, the thing is this. Look, there are ways to use choice purposely to desegregate areas, purposely to ensure that there's integration. There's ways to use magnet programs. There's ways to just look at enrollment processes and enrollment, you know, just the way that people are moving. And you have to do it purposely and think about it and make sure that there's diversity. Or you could just say, like we do in Michigan, do what you want, go where you want. But the results speak for themselves. In Michigan, in the last 20 years, the biggest change that we've had in public education is choice. And now here we are. We're ranked 41st in education compared to other states. So really, the question is, do you want to use this purposely to improve education or allow parents who are not educational experts to just go here, there, everywhere and let the, you know, chips fall where they may?
The story is School Choice, Metro Detroit's New White Flight by Mike Wilkinson and Chastity Pratt Dawsey. You can find it at bridgemi.com. And again, lots of interesting things packed into this story include this interactive tool so you can actually see about the district in Metro Detroit that matters to you and see how it's changed. Thanks to both of you. As always, great talking schools with you. Thank you so very much.
Anytime.
Thank you.
And that story was also a part of the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. Support for the DJC comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
If ever there's a time you want your physician to not make a mistake, it's when he or she is making your diagnosis, figuring out exactly what's wrong with you. Yet, doctors who are overworked and stressed do make mistakes, and the results can be fatal. One famous case, actor John Ritter. He was diagnosed and treated for heart attack. He actually had a tear in his aorta, and that's what killed him. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is researching ways to change the way physicians work to give them more time to think, to diagnose. Dr. Vinit Chopra is an assistant professor of internal medicine at the University of Michigan, and he's with the Patient Safety Enhancement Program. Doctor, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Boy, that moment of diagnosis, everything really hinges on getting that right. And then going onward from there.
Yeah, it's the quintessential medical practice, right? So you come to your doctor because you're not feeling well. You're looking for answers. You're looking for treatment. And it's in that few minutes where the doctor assesses you, listens to your story, examines you, and comes up with what they think is going on. It actually determines a lot of what happens in the next few days. And yet, if you think about our practice, very little time and attention has been devoted to how this happens. How does a doctor go from listening to a patient to actually examining them and putting that together into a formal diagnosis?
Well, what is this process of differential diagnosis that doctors are taught in med school? What are you doing mentally?
So most students in medical school are taught to think about diagnosis with respect to systems and conditions that underlie those problems. So let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. A classic story is chest pain. So if somebody shows up with chest pain, you think, well, what are the organs in the chest that can cause that problem? Starting from the outside, working your way in. So could it be the skin, the muscle, the bones, the tissues underlying those structures, and then the heart, the lungs, and the lining of those structures as well. And so students go through a meticulous examination trying to link up findings and symptoms to those structures, coming up with what they think is most responsible for chest pain. Now, there's a couple of problems with the current approach. One is it takes time. So students have to be able to think a little bit about synthesizing all this data to be able to come up with the right answers. And the second approach is you can go wrong. So if you don't know what you're looking for specifically, if that is not on your radar, then you might miss something that's really important. And so we often tell students to focus on those things that are most important and life-threatening, those killer conditions. For chest pain, it's often heart attack. It's tears in the blood vessels or the aorta. Mm-hmm. It's a blood clot in the lung. Or it's some kind of trauma or injury to the lung, what we call pneumothorax. And students often then prioritize their workup to start with those four killer conditions, make sure we're not dealing with that because those are urgent and life-threatening, and then work their way down thinking about the other possibilities to get you an answer.
But the clock is really ticking as they're trying to do all of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the patient is waiting.
Yes.
And so often if you're in a clinic and you have limited time, you're trying to do this very quickly. On the other hand, if you're in the hospital, you're trying to take your time because someone's sick enough to be there, and yet you still have the pressures of the external environment, other patients you're caring for, all kinds of distractions with noise, with pagers and whatnot, in trying to make this sort of resolution of what the patient's symptoms might be due to.
Well, you and your colleague, Dr. Sanjay Saint of the VA Ann Arbor Health System, are studying why mistakes happen. So I want to start with your treatment of the thought processes that can lead to errors. You identify three problem areas. What is anchoring bias?
Sure. Well, let me start with sort of thinking about diagnoses and about some of the examples that actually illustrate these examples. So some diagnoses are obvious. So for instance, if an older man comes to you and says, my eye has been burning and I have this really sharp pain around the eye and I've noticed some clear vesicles or blisters happening around the skin, the diagnosis is obvious. In fact, you can make it on the phone. It's herpes zoster or shingles. And this makes a lot of sense based on the age, the person's presentation, the severity of pain. On the other hand, some diagnoses are more difficult. So the chest pain example is a good one. Chest pain can be due to a lot of things. It could be due to a lot of conditions, some life-threatening and some not. And so you need to think through what processes and what systems may be at play. We often, however, don't think about those things systematically. As you go from a novice to an expert, you make shortcuts, you make assumptions based upon what you're seeing and what you're used to treating. The classic example is chest pain. If you're an emergency room doctor and you're looking at chest pain every day, and 9 out of the 10 chest pains that you see end up being due to heart attack or to reflux, you are going to anchor on those diagnoses. You're going to think about those first and foremost. These are cognitive shortcuts, what we call heuristics, that are actually quite helpful. So when a patient comes to you with a diagnosis that's obvious, you make that leap, just like the person with the rash around the eye. You know that's zoster. But on the other hand, you're still making those shortcuts. You're still using those shortcuts. So they're actually quite helpful. In some situations, though, they're not.
Like John Ritter,
where you're thinking about a specific diagnosis. You're not stopping to think about whether or not this is the right one.
It almost puts blinders on.
Yeah. And you're using, it's actually a protective mechanism. You're using this to try to come up with an answer for a life-threatening condition. But you often have to stop and think, is this the only possible life-threatening condition? What else could this be?
And what about availability bias?
So availability is another form of a cognitive heuristic. Essentially, it's the type of bias where you're focusing on what you're going to be seeing every single day. So if you're in a busy emergency department and all the patients you see with chest pain tend to be non-cardiac chest pain, you're focusing on that because it's the first thing you think about. Just like anchoring, where you're actually focusing on the first few facts of information, availability is framing that to actually think about what you're seeing every day. If that same patient were to be seen by a different doctor, they would use a different frame because they're seeing different types of patients.
And premature closure.
That's a particularly problematic problem with diagnosis. Premature closure refers to when you're not thinking about how the pieces fit together and whether or not some pieces may actually point to a different diagnosis. So let me give you an example, one that happened to me a few years ago. A young lady who comes to the emergency department complaining of chest pain. She's 45 years old. She has no other medical problems. It's odd that somebody like that would have chest pain. The ER doctors do the right thing. They get blood tests. They do an x-ray. They find a patch in her lung. They think she has pneumonia. And so they give her antibiotics and they send her home and they say, come back in a few days if you're not any better. Well, 5 days go by. She comes back. And she's complaining of chest pain again. Same position, same site. The emergency room doctor looks at the records in the past, sees that they were diagnosed with pneumonia, gets another chest x-ray, finds the same patch, and wonders, well, why did they not improve?
With the antibiotics?
With the antibiotic. Yeah. Maybe it's a resistant bug. Maybe they just didn't have enough of a course. And so they're rationalizing all of the new findings based upon the old perception.
Got it.
They're not stopping to think, well, could this be something else? They actually asked her a few more questions. So have you been around sick people? She says, oh, yeah, my nephew, he's in daycare. He's been sniffling for a week, which only further reinforces their perspective that this has got to be an infection. And so they give her a different course of antibiotics and send her home again. 4 days later, she now comes back with some fever and she's coughing up blood and she's not feeling better. At this point, she gets admitted to the hospital where I get to see her. Now, I'm coming in at the tail end of this.
Fresh eyes.
With fresh eyes. With the knowledge that she's been exposed to two different courses of antibiotics, mm-hmm. what we call hindsight. And so I first and foremost thought there's something else going on. And when I spoke to her a little bit more, I began to get some more information that was pertinent. So she told me she'd lost 15 pounds in the past 6 months, unintentionally. She told me she was a heavy smoker and she's been trying to quit for the past several years, but hasn't been able to. In fact,
I know where this might be going.
You're exactly right. So we got a CAT scan to get a better look. And sure enough, she had a tumor there. It was not a pneumonia. Now, tumors can block the lung and certainly cause pneumonia, but that I don't think that was her primary problem. In this case, we made the diagnosis fairly quickly, but the Institute of Medicine thinks that approximately millions of patients will have diagnostic errors during their lifetime, you and me included. Mm. And so in this case, this was a good ending. We were able to figure out what the problem was. In many cases, we sometimes don't.
Well, then what needs to change in the physician's environment and schedule and mindset, all three, to help a physician find the time and space needed to really think?
Yeah, that's the holy grail, isn't it,
yeah.
Cynthia? A lot has to change. And I think first and foremost, the solutions have to come from outside medicine. We often think of these as intersectional innovations. Mm-hmm. The often used metaphor is aviation and how aviation has changed the culture and safety of healthcare. In many ways, I think diagnosis is one of those things. You know, as physicians, we feel very compelled to give patients answers. Even if we don't know the answer for sure, we want to provide some security, some sense of direction to that patient. And often when we do that, we fail to recognize the weaknesses inherent within those logical explanations. Now, engineering, on the other hand, has quite the opposite approach. Everything has to be specific. There have to be very well-defined parameters for function. And if it doesn't meet those particular constraints, then there's something wrong with the system that has to be addressed. And so working with colleagues in engineering and in architecture, two areas that we've found are actually quite likely to change the way physicians behave and think, we're redesigning the process of diagnosis in the hospital setting. So let me give you an example of this. We've been shadowing clinicians for about 200 hours now over the past year in this large project funded by the federal government. And what we've seen is that the pace is hectic. So a typical learner, an intern or a resident, is running around managing many patients during the day. They're often on call, taking care of new patients.
So sleep deprived.
Sleep deprived. They're dealing with data that's coming at them 24/7 in bits and pieces, all related to different patients. And when you watch this, it's almost surreal to me as a physician because I do this all the time. And yet as an outsider, you realize how error prone this system might be. And so what we've been thinking about is, just like you board a plane, is there a way to cue physicians on their daily workflow so that you can actually streamline the process of diagnosis, build in time every day for every person on a diagnostic team to think about, what does my patient have? What information is available to me? Does this really jive with what I'm seeing? And if not, what things could I potentially be missing? Now, the environment is critically important for this.
And thus architecture.
Thus architecture. Now, we don't want to have doctors running away from the field of battle to be in a lounge to think about diagnosis. But we do think that some quiet time is important and some time to be alone to think is important. In fact, a study just published in the BMJ Quality and Safety this year found if you look at cognitive errors and mistakes that doctors make, the two most promising strategies are what they call guided reflection or cognitive forcing strategies. So guided reflection is a form that sounds a little bit like meditation, and it kind of sort of is. It's thinking about your diagnosis and trying to understand what pieces of information work for this, work against it? And what other conditions could possibly be linking to the patient's presentation?
And that is not something easily done if somebody is running from one unit to the next with the pager going and everything else.
That's exactly right. And cognitive forcing is very similar, but perhaps more brutal in that it actually asks a doctor to justify why is it not the other things that also are similar. Force yourself to think about why those diagnoses don't fit. And if you can't, then include them, think about them in your management and workup.
So it sounds like in this study, you're challenging health systems and hospital administrators to be willing to alter hospital designs, create quiet thinking places, and also give medical staff that breather in their schedules.
That's exactly right. We're actually trying to design this so that it works for everyone. So you can't create space in hospitals where space is at a premium. At the same time, you can't take people away from that group process. There is a collective wisdom in coming together. You know, at the end of the day, you sit down, you talk about your patients, what's going on, why aren't you making headway with someone? But at the same time, you need your quiet time.
Let me ask you, is there anything that we as patients or family members of patients should be doing or should be asking to help make sure that we're not getting a rushed or mistaken diagnosis?
Yeah, this is a great question. So I think this is key. The National Academy of Medicine has actually identified the patient as a key stakeholder in diagnosis. And you may think that as being obvious, but it actually isn't. Many times the patients put their complete trust in physicians because they're there for help. And often when the physician says, we're thinking you have this particular condition or we're going to do these tests, patients accept it. And what we as patients need to be thinking more about is, but tell me why you think that might be. Are there other conditions, perhaps, that may be at play? You know, one piece of information that you might have forgotten or that you said that I think may not be correct is the following. And being a partner with your physician, not to be oppositional, that's not the point of this, but to be a partner so that the information is constantly vetted from various people in the diagnostic process, not the least of which is you, who stands to either benefit the most or be harmed the most by the diagnostic process.
Fascinating stuff. And you can actually read more in Dr. Chopra's piece, co-authored with Dr. Saint, Harried Doctors Can Make Diagnostic Errors. They Need Time to Think. Just go to theconversation.com. Interesting work. When do you feel that you'll have this study kind of, you're working with engineering, working with architecture? Do you have a kind of a date in sight?
Yeah, the study's funded for 3 years. Mm-hmm. So we have 3 more years. We finished our first year. We're going to start rolling out interventions or things to test in as early as this year. Thinking about the process of mindfulness, thinking about reflection in the workplace setting. By year 3 or year 4, I think we'll have a better sense of what really seems to be the best bet. And by year 4, we're going to hopefully sort of put that in place at the VA and at the University of Michigan.
Dr. Vineet Chopra, Assistant Professor of Internal Medicine at the University of Michigan, where he's also part of the Patient Safety Enhancement Program. Doctor, thank you so much for being part of the Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
It's back. Michigan Radio is embarking on another round of Am I Curious? We're looking for your vote, and our digital media director, Mark Brosh, is here now to tell us more. Just remind us again, Mark, for those who might be new to the party, how did the project begin and what are we doing?
Well, the Am I Curious project is all based in hearing from the audience. So when we gather in the newsroom, we all have ideas of stories we want to cover, but we don't often get to hear from the audience. So this really is a project geared towards answering questions from the audience that they submit to us, and we go out and try to answer them with the audience.
And you have certainly, in the time that this project's been going on, dug into a really wide array of different questions.
Yeah. There's been a wide variety of questions out there. So we've dug into questions like, were there ever pirates on the Great Lakes? We've answered that question. Why doesn't roadkill get picked up in a timely manner is another question we've answered. And then often you see way stations out there that are often closed. So somebody wrote in and said, why are all these way stations closed all the time? It really runs the gamut.
Well, you have 3 nominee questions that are now up for a vote. What are they?
Well, this week we have a voting round. So 3 questions are up for a vote. One question came from an anonymous person. They want to know, why doesn't Michigan have a good passenger train system? So that's one question that's up for a vote. The other question that's up for a vote is, who rents or leases all the orange barrels at road construction sites around the state? And then Bert Lenski is a retired school teacher from Manchester, and here's why she asked her question.
I asked the question because I go for breakfast to McDonald's in the morning, and the farmers come in for breakfast and coffee. And I heard them talking about the wells on the properties that they have or the neighbors have. So I started observing the wells, and I noticed that some of them stopped pumping. So I became curious why.
So she's curious about why the oil wells on those farm fields have stopped pumping. So she wrote in with her question.
Well, they're all very different, and so it's time for people to vote. How do they do that?
Well, you can do one thing, which is really easy. Google Am I Curious, the letters Am I Curious, and that will pop up in your Google search, and you can go vote there. You can also go to our website, and you'll find the voting module in the right rail of our website, michiganradio.org.
And what's the deadline?
They have a week to vote.
All right. So get your votes in on the topic, whether it's the wells on farms, why we don't have a better passenger train system in the state of Michigan, and those orange barrels that are everywhere. We have healthy crops of them on the roads. Michigan Radio's Mark Brush with the latest round of Am I Curious questions. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Picture a tree, and it has two branches, one bursting with green leaves, the other struggling to remain viable. That tree is Detroit, and those two branches represent the two very different narratives that we've seen play out this week. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. And Daniel, as you put it in the opening line of your column today in the news, the symbolism could hardly be more jarring.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you know, this week we had Dan Gilbert announce, or Shinola, the Detroit watch company, announce that they were going to be building a boutique hotel in Detroit in conjunction with Dan Gilbert's Bedrock Real Estate Services. And I think what's really striking here is that this is another very posh, very upscale, very hip project for Detroit. By my count, it would be at least the fifth boutique hotel project in the city. And you're reminded of really what's going on in downtown. And in the same week, you've got yet more Detroit public school principals who are sentenced for their roles in defrauding the taxpayers and defrauding the districts into hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And in turn, defrauding the students.
I mean, this maintains a certain narrative. And at the same time, I mean, speaking of the students, you've got people that are filing a civil rights lawsuit against the state, specifically against the governor, saying, listen, these kids have been cheated for a long time. Frankly, I'm surprised it's taken this long for somebody to come together and file a civil rights lawsuit against the state for the condition of the Detroit public schools, but it's finally happening. But I think those things really show you what's happening in Detroit, and it's not an either-or proposition. It's both.
And we've heard this all along, and you've said it. Other observers have said it as the city struggled through the bankruptcy. But the schools and the education underpin everything.
I don't think there's any question that if you don't repair and have a functioning school system that can produce kids that can actually compete for jobs in the marketplace and or compete for places in colleges and universities, it's a barrier to a lot of middle-class families to start to repopulate some of the neighborhoods. Now, clearly, we've got some neighborhoods in Detroit that are in good shape, others that are not, many that are not. And everybody is not going to want to move downtown. And everybody's not going to want to live on the river and pick your neighborhood. So I think that is clearly a disincentive for a lot of middle-class families to consider opportunities in Detroit. And in addition, you've got the issue of property taxes, which tend to be very high, especially in the nicest neighborhoods in the city. The Duggan administration has moved, by my count, in three consecutive years to reduce property taxes, which is fabulous and very unusual in Detroit, but those property taxes are still much higher than they are in a lot of neighboring communities.
The developments like a Shinola Hotel, I mean, why does it matter? And will those developments really make a difference to the people whose kids are going to the crummy schools, the people in the neighborhoods who stuck it out?
Well, clearly a lot of people would say it won't make a difference, but I think it does make a difference to the narrative of the city and the enthusiasm of the city. And does that mean that other people are going to be looking to invest? I think the answer to that is yes, probably. I mean, it's a whole mosaic of issues, but I think there's nothing but good that can come from continued development in downtown, and also for investors, whether they're small investors and single investors looking to buy one or two houses and rehab them and flip them, or major investors who are looking at hotel projects or other kinds of new construction. All of that redounds to the benefit of the city, to the tax base, to people. One of the things that's very, very important to continued development, and particularly retail development, services, whether it's dry cleaners and other things, is people. You need people. You need them downtown. You need it in other neighborhoods. You know, I've seen some postings of some columns I've written recently where people have really been cynical about what's happening in Detroit. And there have been people that have posted and said, hey, I don't think you understand. I mean, where I live, I'm seeing condos being bought for $200,000, $300,000, and $400,000. These are bought in the city of Detroit. So this whole notion that people are just giving away real estate is just a very dated assumption. It just is not really the case anymore. But until you're able to get your arms and think around the schools and be able to say, hey, we're moving in the right direction, there's only so far that you're going to go, and there's only so far that the Gilbert Renaissance is going to go, because the barrier is going to be public education and, to a lesser extent, taxation and public services.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, as always, thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
You realize you're not getting through a day without hearing voices, and only you can hear them. You wonder, what's wrong? How do I make these voices stop? Hearing voices is known as an auditory hallucination. The Mental Health Foundation tells us that it may or may not be associated with a mental health problem. It is the most common type of hallucination in people with disorders such as schizophrenia. Traditionally, if you speak openly about hearing voices, it's likely you're labeled, medicated, even hospitalized. But Hearing Voices Network, HVN, thinks it's got another way to help people understand and learn to live with those voices. Here with us is psychologist Rebecca Hatton. She started the Ann Arbor chapter of the Hearing Voices Network. And with her is Anna, who's a trained facilitator for HVN. Anna has schizophrenia. She began hearing voices in her late teens, and she credits Hearing Voices Network for giving her the feeling of healing rather than hiding. Welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you for having us.
Yes. Rebecca, you have worked for years in the mental health field. Why do you believe the Hearing Voices Network is a better approach for people like Anna who hear voices?
HVN is very empowering and welcoming to people. It does not take a lot of the assumptions that professionals have and things that we assume about, you know, that schizophrenia is a brain disease, it's a neurological defect. And instead, it really looks at this as a natural human experience that happens to many people. If it is disruptive and difficult, then it may be related to real life experiences that people have had. It's a response to difficulties. This is such a humanizing and connecting way of looking at this rather than disconnecting people and stigmatizing.
So is the idea that by coming together at Hearing Voices Network, people learn to live with the voices, not try to drive them away or shut them up?
Very much. People can transform their relationship with their voices. You know, one woman talks about how her most abusive and difficult voice has become her biggest, her strongest supporter. You know, we all have thoughts in our minds, our heads, that we can sort of cheerlead ourselves, encourage ourselves, or we can criticize and
tear ourselves down.
Yes, yeah. Be very harsh. It's a little bit more embodied with among voice hearers. It's a little bit different experience, but it can evolve in the same way.
Anna, you were, what, around 19 when you first began hearing voices?
Yes, when I first, moved away and went off to college. And everything was going well until the voices came, and then things got really weird really quick.
How so?
So I started hearing voices in maybe mid-October. At first, they were describing everything that I was doing, and that kind of terrified me at first, thinking that people were listening and watching me in my dorm room. But things progressively got worse and worse. Over a course of 3 weeks, I went to a party out of state, and at the time, I was looking forward to that party. But as soon as I got into my car when I was by myself, I was hearing voices in my car. So now I'm like, it's not just cameras in my dorm room, it's something else that's going on. From there, things got worse and worse. I was getting more frightened, more scared. When the voices started telling me that they were going to kill me, that's when things hit rock bottom.
I guess so.
Quickly.
And what happened then?
Well, I was terrified of staying in my dorm room, so I ended up calling my best friend, and I'm like, hey, best friend, I'm coming. But before I actually made it into her house, I was sitting in the parking lot of my car, and I started, tearing my car apart looking for cameras.
You say voices, so
yes.
It was more than one.
Yes.
Right. Are they judging? Are they just commenting? What were the voices saying to you?
At the time, the thing that scared me was that they were going to kill me.
Were they voices of people you knew or just voices that were...
Voices of people I knew.
Okay. So you'd hear a voice of whoever that was, as clear as anything.
Yes.
And becoming threatening.
Yes.
And then you wound up hospitalized.
Yes.
Tell us about that, because my understanding is that was not a helpful experience.
No, that was actually quite terrifying in every single way possible. When I got to the hospital, my voices changed the conversation to not we're going to kill you, but the staff in the hospital are going to kill you. And so that threw my psychosis further down the hill of sanity. I was very fearful of the staff. And, like, I would pace myself every night for a couple of nights, pacing myself so that I don't go to sleep, because I was afraid that if I was going to go to sleep, that I would get killed. But when I fell asleep, I was woken up immediately almost afterwards, and I was injected with something. And at that point, the voices were like, see, this is proof you're going to die in this hospital.
I'm watching you, Rebecca, as you hear Anna talk. This is a common thing?
Yes. Our response to people in crisis, I think, is often not as helpful as it could be.
Medicaid.
It's coerced treatment against someone's will, and so that people who are already feeling threatened or
traumatized,
fearful, yes, that isn't helpful, you know.
And, like, with that, I want to point out, with the medication, now it's like I have voices that I have no idea what the heck is going on with me. And now I have these drugs in my body that I have no idea what they're doing to me. The side effects were horrific. At one point, I was injected with whatever they injected me with, and they didn't say what it was. They just said doctor's orders. And at that point, it's like, okay, now I have lockjaw. I'm like frozen. I'm staring up at the ceiling. My friend is visiting me. My friend is trying to get me to go to bed. But I'm like staring at the ceiling like this, and I physically cannot put my head down. And it took like an hour for the nurses to finally like make me stop doing that.
And we like to think, we, society, well, talk to a psychiatrist, get therapy, talk to a psychologist, talking it out will help. That's not what happened here, was it?
I never actually got any talk therapy that was real. The only thing that I was given was just like a bunch of medication. They did nothing for the voices, but the side effects were atrocious. At the end of the hospitalization, after 30 days in the hospital, because I was court ordered at first, I didn't want to take the medication, and then I had no choice. But at that point, it's like, okay, take these medicine, have a good day, goodbye.
Out you go.
Yeah.
Well, then what happened then after that 30 days? You were back out in the world.
I was back out. At that point, I had left college. I moved back in with my family, but I did not get better. I ended up getting hospitalized again shortly afterwards, maybe a month after getting out the first time around. I ended up going to a police station, and in the police station, I was like, excuse me, officer, can you please give me a note so that I can go to the hospital and they could diagnose me as having ESP? And the officer looks at me and he's like, I have no idea what to do in this situation. So he calls his supervisor over. His supervisor is like, I'm sorry, ma'am, we cannot help you with that. Mm-hmm. So me being me, I've always been an optimist by nature. I'm like, well, I don't have this police note to try to get this diagnosis of ESP. Let me go to the emergency room and see what happens with my luck. Well, I go in there, I ask to be diagnosed with ESP because in my mind at the time, a diagnosis of ESP was better than a diagnosis of schizophrenia. Mm. At the time, it's like everything that I heard about schizophrenia was hopeless and it sounded awful and I wanted nothing to do with it. So I'm like, well, give me this diagnosis. Well, I didn't get the diagnosis. I ended up going back to the hospital and I really got diagnosed with schizophrenia.
That whole cycle, being on meds, being off meds, because the meds have such awful side effects. Tell me what happens when someone like Anna comes to the Hearing Voices Network. How does it break this cycle?
Well, even in training now, I think the very common view is that it is either a waste of time or it's actually very risky to talk with someone in depth about their voices. We want to know what voices are saying in case they might be saying something hazardous. You know, we don't think about some of the approaches that HVN has taken.
Such as
something called voice dialogue, where you bring the voices into the room. A person can talk with a person's voices. you know, it's a bit of imaginative work. Sometimes groups will even have role played different voices for someone so that they can really get in and see, you know, you want to know, why did the voice come? What was happening in your life when they started? What purpose do these voices have? A lot of times voices are working very hard to help someone. They may be doing it in a very clunky and difficult way. They
Such
don't
as
know.
Happened when you're dorm room, Anna, right?
Yes.
Yes.
You know, that sounds like that may have been a protective voice in some way. It may have been trying to help Anna stay safe from something that she was dealing with people. And
so I don't know. I have a hard time believing that because mm-hmm. I feel like at the time my voice was just wanting to be destructive.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Mm-hmm. But I do also want to say, like, a lot of what HVN does goes hand in hand with conventional therapy and psychology mm-hmm. too, because a lot of people in our groups, they still do take their medicine.
But it's
yes.
pro-choice.
Pro-choice, yeah.
If it works for you, great, take it. If it doesn't, try something else.
So you come to Hearing Voices Network?
Almost 2 years ago. So up until I heard about HVN, I had no support. I talked about my voices not at all with anyone. I was terrified of going back to the hospital, and I didn't want people on the outside world, like people I work with, to know where exactly I came from.
And the voices are still there.
Yes.
But because of HVN, how do you regard them now?
Now I can talk about them, and I don't try to hide in the shadows. It's a completely 180 degrees. Now I'm actually, like, sharing my experience.
Do voices ever stop?
For yes. some people, yes. For some people, no. Mm.
And if they don't, then mm-hmm. that's
your life. Good luck.
They can change very much. Just mm-hmm. as when people work through issues in their lives and change their negative thinking comes in a different form, you know, maybe depressive thinking or panic attacks and things like that, that can evolve and progress and change that thinking so that people get better and recover. The very same thing is very common in HVN. Once people have the idea that it's possible, they have power with their voices. They have a say. They have a voice themselves. Some people, their voices do fade and they're gone as they work through things. Others, one of my mentors is a Scotsman who was diagnosed for 13 years. He was homeless, alcoholic, you know, he still hears voices, but he teaches around the world. He's a clinician. He runs recovery camps and things like that. And he said, after his father's death, his father's voice sort of joined this little group of voices that are with him. When he went to see his mom, she would say, "So, what's Dad up to? How's he doing?" You know, it just became another part of his thoughts. Yes.
His thoughts. Is this accepted in the psychiatric community?
It's largely unknown. HVN is fairly widespread, especially in English-speaking countries and in Europe. There are over 200 active groups in the United Kingdom, for example, but it only came to the United States formally about 5 years ago. You know, we're a bit late to the party, so to speak.
Rebecca, tell us about the informational events you have coming up.
There'll be an informational meeting open to the public all about HVN on September 18th at the Friends Meeting House in Ann Arbor. 2 days later, our regular Hearing Voices Network meeting, we will have an open house. Anyone will be welcome to come and see how it goes, what it's like.
The website is hearingvoicesusa.org. You'll find information and the locations of HVN chapters all over the country. Rebecca Hatton is the founder of the Ann Arbor chapter of Hearing Voices Network. Anna has been living with schizophrenia, and she's a facilitator with the Hearing Voices Network. We want to thank both of you very much for coming in and sharing your story and your work with us here on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.